I want them to feel a little bit confused. I want them to have to start thinking, if they spend enough time with it, a little bit critically about what is it they're looking at? Why is it there? What is it doing? I want them to ask questions. I do not want to give people answers. I really just want them to question. I'm happy if they scratch their heads and go, I don't know, because a lot of times I don't know either. And the question that artists often get asked is, what does it mean? That's a very good question, and I cannot answer that, because it means something to me, but it means something else to somebody else.
Voices with value, stories with soul, tools for transformation. This is Innovation Insights. Innovate so you do not stagnate. Welcome to another episode of Innovation Insights, where we dive deep into the minds shaping the future of industries through innovation, creativity, and groundbreaking research. We believe that innovation happens in all aspects of life. I am your host, Dr. Yolanda Sanders. Today's guest invites us into a space that is both geographic and deeply personal, a space she calls the middle of nowhere. But as you'll soon discover, there's a lot of something out there. Sky, sagebrush, ancient stories, and a creative space that blends land, light, and imagination. Jennifer Reif is a Wyoming-based artist who creates ephemeral installations in natural landscapes. Works that are quietly powerful, intimately constructed, and intentionally fleeting. Influenced by land art, but rooted in sustainability, Jennifer challenges the notion of permanence in art. She crafts objects from found materials, places them delicately in wild environments, then removes them, leaving behind only a photograph, GPS coordinates, and a memory of the moment. Her journey began on long drives across the wide open West, where the land itself became both canvas and collaborator. From rural Colorado to coastal cities and back to the vast prairies of Wyoming, Jennifer's work reflects a lifelong dialogue with solitude, scale, and the scars we leave on the earth. In this episode, we talk about process over product, the stories behind her environmental installations, and how creating in the middle of nowhere can actually bring us closer to everything that matters. So settle in and let's step off the beaten path with Jennifer Reif. Welcome to the podcast, Jennifer. I'm so happy to have you here.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here. I really am honored to be invited.
Oh, you are certainly a blast from my past.
And you mine. This is great.
No.
And we just look wonderful.
It's fabulous. Gosh, we met in Lamar, Colorado with the Lamarlin swim team, I think.
Yes.
I think you were a coach for a while, too, weren't you?
I was. I think we were both swimmers for a while. And then when I got to be, I think it was a junior or senior in high school, I was assistant coach. And then I was head coach for a couple of years while in college. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. And just always been someone that I've looked up to. My family looked up to you and your husband, and just, you know, you have these individuals that, you know, yeah, or in your life or in your community that you're like, wow, they're amazing. I want to be like them when I grow up. And you were one of them.
Thank you. The feeling is mutual. I have so much respect for you, your sister, your mom, your dad. I mean, the Sanders family is just the Sanders family, and you winning all the 4-H fashion shows. You were very talented with fashion at a very young age. At a very young age. I remember well.
You're very kind. Yeah, I've had some conversations with people recently about, oh, are you still designing? I'm like, no. There's so many people in the world that don't even know that I have this whole life as a designer. So this is always funny when it comes up.
It's still in there, right?
It is. These days, I'm trying to design podcast clips and things like that.
It's still design. Creative life takes a lot of twists and turns. And I worked as a graphic designer for a long time, and I've done other things that it's all creative. It all taps into your creative resources, and it might not be in fashion right now, but you may come back to it. You may not, but you're still creating, right?
Yep, I am. That really leads us to you and your journey. So could you tell us about your background and your journey, and how did you get from Lamar, Colorado to Cheyenne, Wyoming?
Oh, it's a very long, winding story. It started in Lawrence, Kansas, actually, where I was born, and then my family moved to Lamar. Yeah, going back that early, having mentioned you and 4-H fashion shows, I remember just wanting to be an artist from a very young age, and I didn't really know what that meant. But my parents were both makers. They just made whatever they needed. My dad welded the most amazing swing set for us. My mom's would garments without a pattern. She would make bags for us and the most amazing Barbie house out of moving boxes and random leftover, like Nestle's Quick cans became Barbie doll sinks because there was a hole. She was just so creative in that way. And so I grew up with that. And she taught me how to sew. I learned how to just making was part of our lives. And I loved sitting in my sandbox, the mud box, basically in the backyard, making mud pies, whatever. So any chance I got to make, I did. I took all the art classes we possibly could in Lamar schools, which was basically just art. But then when I was a senior in high school, I managed to get a independent study with Miss Burnett. You probably had Miss Burnett.
I did. And I did the same thing. I talked her into one. So thank you for paving the road, because it's, yeah.
Oh, I was very adamant. And so I think my senior year, one semester, I had 3 hours of different art classes, because I also took mechanical drawing, which thought I was going to, I don't know, poke my eye with my pencil or something, because it was too many straight lines and ruler. I didn't get to be the free spirit I wanted to be. Yeah. So then she told me that if I wanted to major in art in college, I had to be prepared to be around a lot of weird people. The witch just laughed because, yeah, I fit in okay with those weird people. Weird.
That's hilarious.
Oh, she was really wonderful. But yeah, so then I went off to college and majored in art and ended up at the University of Kansas, back where I was born. And majored in art history, and because I couldn't decide whether I wanted to be an art historian or an artist, I went the artist route. My degree was a BFA, so I had to have as many studio hours as art history hours, and I focused in ceramics, so I got to play in mud more because I like to make a mess. And as soon as I graduated, my husband and I got married. And Fred also grew up in Lamar, as you know. So we've known each other since we were 3 years old, and we were friends throughout high school, and then got together in college when he was off at the U.S. Naval Academy and I was in Kansas. And then we decided to get married, and so I moved around the country with him while he was a pilot in the Marine Corps. And so we lived in Virginia, North Carolina, Texas, back in Virginia. And then we moved back to Lamar for a while and then decided he found a job up here in Cheyenne. And here we are and have been here for 23 and a half years now. So that's how I ended up in Cheyenne. I thought I would end up in Cheyenne, but I love the wide open spaces of the West. It was really interesting to live where there are lots of forests. I would feel claustrophobic. And so it was kind of nice to get back to the West. So that's my life in a background. Let's see, one of your, my professional journey, that was long background for where, but all that plays into where I am as an artist. Because when I was maybe 7 or 8 years old, we were south of Lamar. And a friend took us, one of my mom's friends, took us into a cave on the land that they ranched on. And there were, I can't remember if there were petroglyphs or pictographs, but I do remember there being some arrowheads in this cave. And I remember my mom's friend saying, "Don't touch anything because you're on sacred ground. This place is sacred." And even just talking about it, I get goosebumps because that was my first, what I would call, real experience with art in the way that it just moved me to the point where I felt something. I felt something so deep. And I remember that so clearly. So that's important for where I am now as well, because that is, we'll probably get to in further questions. That's the experience I'm seeking always when I create out in the land.
Lovely. Oh my gosh. Yeah, you wrapped up 20 some years of life in such a beautiful way.
I think as a creative person, it's important to remember what I was like before I learned what I was supposed to be like. Mm-hmm. And those, I think Picasso said something about trying to remain a child in your creativity all the time. I don't have the quote exactly, but I think it is important to get back to before you were told how to do this, how to do this is how you do that's not good, that's not how you do that. All those things when you could just feel and make and not care what others thought about it.
So true, so true. Are you familiar with Julie Cameron?
Yes.
The Artist's Way. Yeah, I used to use that book when I taught classes on creativity, and that's something that she really talks about too, is going back to that childhood. Yeah, before.
Right. And it's really hard to do as an adult because we've had to grow up, which we should, you know, we should grow up, but to be able to tap back into that. And so I find that my early years and just going back to that cave especially, and experiencing that and that feeling. And that's, I would say that was the first time I truly felt what flow would feel like.
Could you talk a little bit more about flow and what does it mean for our audience that maybe they haven't heard the word? And then what's the experience like?
So I've called myself a flow junkie. Because it's a feeling that is hard to describe, I guess I could best describe it as I lose total track of time, total track of what's going on around me. I'm really not necessarily in my own head, but in a world that seems to be a little bit separated from the present reality. And it's a great place for creating. That doesn't mean that everything just goes the way I want it to, but it means that I can really just lose myself into solving whatever creative problems are before me. And I'm always seeking that experience. And that's what I have when I'm out in the land working.
It sounds like a great place to be. Recall flow at times.
Yeah, it's not a place you can live in forever.
No, but it is an important part of the creative journey. And
yes.
Yeah.
And it's, I wish that I could I wish I could describe it better, but I think it's something that you have to truly experience. And then you go, oh, that's what it is. That's what it feels like.
I think you gave a really great definition of it. So what do you mean by the middle of nowhere? What does that mean to you?
So growing up in Southeast Colorado, sometimes, because this was back when cars were pretty basic and we didn't have cell phones and things, your car might break down in the middle of nowhere, which means that there's no civilization, there's no house. You know what it looks like in Southeast Colorado. You can drive for 80 miles and there is no civilization. You might see a house off in the distance, you might pass a few cars, but the middle of nowhere geographically is truly so much of the Western United States, which can feel very daunting in a way. When I spoke about living on the East Coast, when my husband was in the Marine Corps and I would meet people who would have to move from Virginia to California to change duty stations, or they had come from California to Virginia and they would say, there's nothing out there from like Nevada to Missouri. There's nothing. There is nothing. And I would argue with them and say, oh no, there's a whole lot of something. There are bones out in fields from animals that have died, and you know, the circle of life, now they're bleached bones, and there are petroglyphs and pictographs, and they're interesting rocks, and you got to look up at the sky and you can see this thunderstorm that's 50 miles away, and you just get to watch the lightning, but it's not going to hit you. And so that's the middle of nowhere geographically, and the middle of nowhere psychologically, emotionally. If you live long enough, we all feel it. It's grief. It's drastic change where you just kind of feel lost. And so when I'm creating installations, I will be geographically out in the middle of nowhere usually. But one of my favorite installations was actually along the shore of Lake Michigan in Chicago, which is not the middle of nowhere geographically, but at the period of my life, it was very much the middle of nowhere emotionally. And it was that installation really will always stick in my mind as, I don't want to say my favorite, but just a very profound one for me, because the wind was howling. It was a stormy day and the wind almost blew me over. A wave took some of my objects out into the lake and the images ended up shaky, not blurry, but shaky. And the final images were just so indicative of the day and where I was psychologically, that it just meant, they mean a lot to me because of how they reflected the moment.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Absolutely. Oh, tell us about the installation process, because I've had other artists on and one does some installations, but we really didn't talk about that. We talked about his animation work, but we don't have a lot of people that do installations. It is a different process than creating one singular piece.
I'll start with the objects. I create the objects in my studio with no specific intent for where they will be installed. I will just have the idea for the objects, looking around at the stuff I have in my studio or in my garage, or I'll go to the Habitat for Humanity Restore and just look for pieces, just a variety of things, kind of talking about my mom making things for my Barbie house. I just use random objects to carry out whatever, or materials to carry out whatever object appears in my head. So I'm not necessarily trying to recreate anything. I'm not looking to say, oh, this piece of land would look great with this kind of specific object, so I'm going to create that object. I create the objects, and sometimes they sit around for months, and I don't know where they're going to go, and I'll just pack them up and take them with us on a road trip. So then when I have these objects along, we'll be on a road trip. We stop somewhere, usually public lands. I almost always work on public lands unless I'm invited to private lands because I want to be where all the people can go. And sometimes it's just along the side of the road. But then I'll just get my objects out and see how they fit in that particular landscape, whatever the weather is like. And so it's very spontaneous and serendipitous. And then I install them. I put the objects out. I have to be able to carry everything. That's my rule for myself because I don't have the resources to have bulldozers and like that. And generally, my husband, Fred, will just stay with the car and watch me wander off. And I go do my thing, get into my flow state, and I set up the objects. I take a lot of photographs. I am on the ground half the time. I have an old digital camera that's a fixed lens. I like limitations. I can't see what I'm taking. I can't necessarily see what's in the screen or the viewfinder. I'm just shooting, and I'm often in very odd positions or lying down on the ground. The light reflects off the screen, so I couldn't see it anyway. And so I don't know what my images look like generally. I take the objects down, pack them up, and walk back to the car, and away we go. And that's how my installation process is.
I love it. I love it. And the thing is that it's also a photography process too. So you're a photographer too.
Yes. And I, maybe because I was reined back in the film days, but I don't look at my photos for a couple of weeks usually, and partly because I want to be surprised by them. I don't want to overthink what I did and think, oh, I should have done this shot and think I should go back. Uh-oh. Because it's a moment in time. It's most of the time we're on a road trip, we're not going back for me to get a specific shot. So I just wait. Sometimes I don't look at images for a few months. And then when I look at them, it's, oh, yeah, I remember. It brings back that state of flow a little bit. And I kind of relive the experience, which is enjoyable to me, so that I can tap into my memory. And I don't edit the photos much at all. I try to just have my camera settings the way I want it to be, but I like to be surprised, which is kind of odd because I'm really a but not with this. I am not, when I'm creating, I don't want to be a planner. I just want to experience.
And because it makes me think about your journey in art, because behind you, you have some beautiful basketry work, which definitely is very much planning and very technical. And so you go from that to what you're doing now.
Right.
Tell us about that transition.
So I had mentioned that my studio emphasis in college was in clay. And then while moving around, while Fred was in the Marine Corps, I didn't have a kiln, didn't have access to a kiln, but I did have fabric because I sewed a lot at the time. And a friend gave me some leftover paper coiling core from a basketry class she had taken. And another friend gave me a book on basketry. So I just started using my leftover fabric and started creating these coil baskets and vessels. And they evolved to where I started using raw silk and I dyed it myself. That's the colors that you see there, a hearkening back to Lamar again, Mr. Beverly, who was our junior high art teacher. That's where I first learned how to coil a basket. It's still in my mom's house, that first one. So I achieved a certain amount of success with these, and I had pieces in several galleries, and even one of the galleries went to SOFA Chicago and took some of my work. And, you know, that was pretty darned exciting. But then 2008 hit, and the recession closed a few of the galleries that I had work in, and I kept going. But as time went on, I just wasn't feeling like I was saying what I wanted to say with art, and I wasn't getting the fulfillment out of making that I had before. And pieces from the land started coming into the vessels more. There's one piece you can see right there. That's some grass from grassland.
Wow.
And plumbing parts. And all these things just started coming into these pieces that made for a transition to the objects that ended up out in the land. So it took maybe 3 to 4 years of just this kind of gradual, something's coming. I felt something was coming. I felt a change was coming. I didn't know what the change was. And the change, I think what really sparked the change was going to the Spiral Jetty on the Great Salt Lake, a large, massive, monumental piece of land art by Robert Smithson, with our daughter when she graduated from college. She's an art historian. This does fit it. And so we're walking out on the Spiral Jetty, and it was basically a pilgrimage because the road was, at that time, was almost impassable. It was very difficult to get out there. And there were just two other people there, and my husband, Fred, our daughter, Michaela, and myself. And it was just this amazing flow experience that was like being in that cave in Southeast Colorado. That kind of feeling of, I am at a very special place. And the Great Salt Lake is so otherworldly. And I don't remember how long we were there, but we were there at least a couple hours, but totally lost track of time and place. And getting back home, I realized I want to feel that whenever I'm making art. I didn't know how at that time, but that was a real turning point. And then as Michaela went on through graduate school, I had the opportunity to get to go to lots of museums while she had postdocs and fellowships and all these wonderful things, that I got to see art that I would not have seen otherwise. And she introduced me to British land artists. So that started me down a research path, maybe. And like in a museum, I saw Anna Mendieta's work that was just mind-blowing. And it just gradually was, I'm just going to make these things. I'm gonna put them out there, not quite like Andy Goldsworthy, but because he makes his installations wherever he is in the land. I make mine beforehand and carry them out there. So I thought, I'm just going to do this, and if I never sell art again, at least I'll be doing something that takes me into that flow state. So that's how I transitioned, basically, from these fiber vessels and baskets to doing what I am now. But the funny thing is, I was cleaning my studio one time, found one of my college sketchbooks, and in there was an idea for some sort of windmill-inspired sculpture out in the land in Southeast Colorado.
How interesting.
And then I remembered, oh, yeah, I did have this idea. It just took me 25, 30 years to come around to it. And that's what I'm saying. It's a winding road.
It is a winding road. And I think that's so important for our audience to know that and hear stories like this, because especially our younger audience members, because sometimes when you're younger, you think the path is just straight. You just do that.
Oh, yeah. I don't go from point A to point B. I go from point A to point A1 to point A3 to point A.5.
I love it. I love it. I love it.
And it's, and all along the way, you pick up references. You pick up visual references, you pick up life experience, and it all just, it's all in there to tap into for when you're creating. And you just never know when things are going to pop out.
When you were talking about the points on the journey, that reminds me that you use GPS coordinates to document work. And so you really are a numbers person. Talk to us about your reasoning for doing that.
So I think, you know, with this work, it's, well, let me back up, because my fiber work was also just numbered. And I just give things random numbers. I think a lot of that goes back to E.E. Cummings was my favorite poet. And I like the symbols of number and N-O, or for number, and then the symbols of the numbers themselves. I like the visuals of that. And I think a lot of that goes back to how E.E. Cummings used a lot of punctuation marks and no caps, things to make real symbols in his poetry. And that affected me. And I like the randomness. So when I started doing this work, it was just a natural transition to me from randomly numbering the vessels and baskets I did to using some sort of number for the installations, and the coordinates made sense. I don't write them the way you're supposed to, because I emphasize the longitude before the latitude, because my orientation is not necessarily north and south, but east and west. Because of growing up in the west, it's, if you're west, I think it's 98 west of longitude 98, it gets really dry. And so being oriented more towards the west being dry, the east being wet, that has just been in my psyche, I think, my entire life, whether I knew it or not. So that's where I use the GPS coordinates. I don't go down to the minutes. I don't go down to the seconds. I go down to the minutes. So it's within a radius, because it's not, I don't do anything that exact anymore. It doesn't have to function. I can do what I want. So I just want it to be in the general area, because I walk around a lot too. So when I'm out.
I love it. I love it. I love the combination of numbers, geography, environment, art. You're very interdisciplinary. You've mentioned poetry in this, all the disciplines that really do influence your work and that you're drawing upon.
I think you can find inspiration anywhere. I think there's, you can get inspiration from high culture. You can get inspiration from low culture. It's all in there. And it was all somehow created. I love watching shows on TV that are people being creative, like on HGTV or Project Runway. Love Project Runway. singing competition shows, getting into the process of people creating and their thought processes. And it's, you know, one of the things I always loved about Project Runway, people have to wear these garments. You have to think about the functionality of it. And I don't think about the functionality of anything I do because it's not functioning. It's not pragmatic at all. And that's part of why I do it. But I love the thought process, watching the thought processes, listening to the thought processes, because it's part of the creative process and it feeds into my own creative process. I just like to take it all in.
What do you hope that viewers or participants feel when they view your photographs of your installations or the projections of them?
I want them to feel a little bit confused. I want them to have to start thinking, if they spend enough time with it, a little bit critically about what is it they're looking at? Why is it there? What is it doing? I want them to ask questions. I do not want to give people answers. I really just want them to question. I'm happy if they scratch their heads and go, I don't know, because a lot of times I don't know either. And the question that artists often get asked is, what does it mean? That's a very good question, and I cannot answer that because it means something to me, but it means something else to somebody else. One particular installation I did, I was giving a presentation to some high school students, and I showed this image, and the teacher, who's a friend of mine, he said, those objects make me think of insects. I didn't see that at all. I had not seen that at all. So that's an example of, I want people to bring their own reference points, their own thinking, their own life stories, and maybe what I have done will trigger a memory, hopefully it's a good one, but it will bring up a reference in their visual memory that they can go, oh yeah, like, objects I have sitting right here, they're in the photograph right there. I did not realize what they were or what in my mind had come up that made me want to do these tall cylindrical things until one time I was driving north out of Lamar. I had gone to visit my mom, and right there by Wiley, there's an old alfalfa dehydrator, which is with tall tanks, which that was, my dad ran that business. So I grew up with that. It was just part of my world that I didn't really think about. As I was driving, I'm like, tall rusted cylinders, huh?
Yes.
And that's where, when I make these objects, I'm not necessarily referencing anything in particular, but later on I may say, oh, that's where that came from. And I was giving a talk at an exhibit up in Casper, Wyoming, which has a lot of rural areas around it. And I mentioned that the tall cylindrical tanks, and almost everybody in the room went, I know what you're talking about. Because they have that visual reference too. So that's what I hope that people will say, oh, that makes me think of this, but it's not that, but it makes me think of that.
Oh, that's great, because you're allowing people to ask questions, but sometimes in art and creativity, the thought is that we have to have the answers, or people that are viewing it want the answer. Like you said, they'll ask, what does this mean? And it's important to allow people to have bring their own meaning and references to it.
And that can be really hard for people, really hard. And it's not going to hurt. It's like abstract art is not really going to hurt you. It may make you think. It may get your wheels turning a lot, but it's not going to reach out and bite you. Or maybe maybe some artist will make something that it'll reach out and bite you. I don't know. That's not my intent. My intent is just to make you go, huh, what is that? Why is it there? Because there's so much in our world that, and I think it is particularly out in the land, because here in Wyoming, we're an energy extraction colony, basically. All over the land is dotted with oil wells, derricks, pump jacks, pipelines. That's Wyoming, because we also have lots of dinosaur bone. That's this state. And I hope that people will just say, why is that there?
Yeah.
Why is it on the land, and what are we doing by having it there? What are the consequences of that? Just get thought process.
Thank you for creating art that encourages people to think, because sometimes we're in a world where we have so much information that's thrown at us all the time. We just want the answers quick. We want a quick TikTok that'll tell us how to do something, a quick YouTube video that'll tell us. But to be able to cognitively think, reflect, it's good.
Yeah. That's my purpose. No shade on artists who do work that does give answers. That's very valuable as well. But my own direction is ask questions. Take that winding journey.
That's good. And another thing that I really appreciate about our conversation is that you've done a nice job of really communicating the narrative or the references or inspiration for your work. And that is not immediate. We both have had work in juried exhibitions and
together.
Yes, together even, which is just wild too.
Very wild.
Same exhibition. Yeah, international ones that we had no idea that we both were submitting to. We hadn't even talked to each other. That was just wild. When you submit to exhibitions, oftentimes you're asked to write, what was your inspiration? Honestly, sometimes I just had to make it up because I was like, I'm not really sure. Okay, this seems
right.
When you were talking about seeing objects or going back to southeastern Colorado, then you see something like, oh, that's what I was referencing. You did a nice job. And I think that's important for artists to realize that sometimes they're drawing upon things that they don't realize.
Exactly, because I don't think I'm alone in, as a creative person, having a really intense visual memory. My first very vivid memory is from right after I turned 2. And it's such a vivid memory that it's almost like a videotape in my head. I can go back to that. There are just so many millions of visual references in my brain. It's so hard to pick out the exact one that a particular object may reference until I see it again. And then it's all, yeah, like I was talking about. And that's one thing I hate about juried exhibitions or writing an artist statement or anything. That's, tell us more. Tell us, what are you referencing? Like you said, what are you referencing here? It's, I don't know that thing I saw when I was 5 that I didn't know what. It's hard to pinpoint, and I think that that's trying to put art in too much of a box instead of letting it out of the box. It doesn't have to be so defined.
I agree. And having also been the person that has either created juried exhibitions or taught students, and I've said, okay, now you need to articulate in writing what important that you do this, because no one understands artists or designers, and so we can't be viewed as flaky. We have to write what we do and explain it to the rest of the world, because
you have nailed it. Yes. And yeah, I'm old enough that I don't feel like I have to explain it all. You're exactly right. And there is value in being able to articulate about your work, to talk about your work, to answer questions. But it's also valuable to me to be able to say, I don't know. I can't answer that question about my work because I honestly don't have the answer. And I'm okay with saying that. It took me a long time to get there, an awful long time to get there, to be comfortable with saying, I can't give you that answer.
Yeah, that is so good. Now we can get the rest of the world to accept that, because part of Innovation Insights is that we're a coaching and consulting agency plus a design agency. So helping individuals, and sometimes it's faculty that are design or art oriented, tell their stories in 10 years. As I sit here and say, yeah, we shouldn't have to do this, the other side of me is going to be helping people explain what they do so that, you know,
right,
someone that's a bench scientist that's looking at their work can understand.
Right. Communication about, speaking of scientists, that's an area of communicating very complex ideas and subjects to people who don't have the reference points.
Absolutely.
And having, in my former day job that I retired from, I coordinated exhibits. And one of the exhibits I coordinated was a book arts exhibit. And I would work with a curator every year. And one that I spoke with, and I worked at a public library, which all these people coming in for a variety of reasons. The general public, you want to see them, go to the public library. We determined it was really important to give people an access point into the art. To give some, we would tell people they had to do a tweet, 140 characters that will just give a viewer who may know nothing about art some access point, a word, a sentence that makes them say, oh, I can now look at this and have a reference. So it's communication is, at times I don't want to say a thing, and other times, yes, I have to be able to, articulate this, or I'm undermining my work a little bit. And I don't want to do that either.
No. Oh, that is so true. And thank you for sharing the both sides. You have to do both. Now, you mentioned working at the library. And I want to tap into that because, again, you've had a wonderful, varied career and professional journey. How did working at the library, and I think in a previous conversation, you did also some graphic design work for the library too. And so how did all of that play into your work as a creative, and how did you integrate that?
It was so important and valuable because I consider myself so fortunate to have a job that tapped into my creativity at a place with a very valuable mission for the community. And I was fortunate that we had wonderful exhibition spaces. So I got to have this dual job of coordinating exhibitions and also creating graphic design. And I got to meet so many artists and so many, I not only coordinated art exhibits, but also history exhibits and science exhibits. And so I got to tap into a plethora of subject matter. And you work at a library and you work with a lot of very intellectually curious people. And people who come to the library, there's a lot of very intellectually curious people who come. And so it was really valuable. And for my own work, it relieved the burden of having to be commercially successful with my own artwork, because the day job provided the means to living. Mm-hmm. And so I was free to do these crazy different objects and land installations and not have to be concerned whether anybody ever wanted to buy any of my photographs or not. Because usually when I exhibit, people see the work via a projection on a loop of different stills from the series that of the installation, and I only print on demand. So my job relieved my art, and that was very freeing, very freeing.
That's good.
And I think that's something that I think that artists often think that having a day job, call it that, just to distinguish from the art, whether it's being an administrative assistant or a professor or like what I did, design and exhibitions coordinator, that was many jobs rolled into one. That's not necessarily a bad thing. And it doesn't mean that you're not a successful artist, because very few artists get to just make a living off of their art. And then it's subject to the whims of the economy and the market and those kinds of things that can be very stifling creatively. So I was fortunate. I was fortunate to have a job that suited me well, and that I got to create a little bit because I was the first one to have it.
Love it. Love it. That is such great advice for emerging artists. Do you have any other advice that you would give an emerging artist or someone that wants to tap more into their creativity or innovation?
I would say go there. When you have that idea that seems way out there, go there anyway.
Okay.
Just take the leap and try it. It may not succeed. Be bold. I have a good friend who says the answer is always no until you ask. And so if you think about that in terms of creativity, if you don't allow yourself to try that, you won't know. The answer will be no. And sometimes it takes a while to get to yes. You have to be willing to fail. You have to be willing to have work that is, you don't have to show anybody that work that.
Oh, yeah.
Some things can just stay in your own little world, but to just be willing to not be afraid. And I can't say that I've arrived or that I'm perfect at it, because it is. And we're all afraid of failing to a degree. We want to be successful. And when things take time and then it ends up being a bust.
Yes.
But sometimes you don't know when that thing that was a bust, that idea was a bust, might come back around. I recently just had an idea from 10 years ago finally come to a point where I am excited about where it's going. I tried to force it. It was too literal. And it took 10 years. That's a long time. That's a long time. I didn't have as much white hair 10 years ago. The passage of time happens.
Sometimes it has to be the right time and space. Sometimes the stars aren't aligned. People aren't ready. You might be ahead of your time. And like you said, pushing something.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I think it's also important for younger artists to realize that everything is a reinvention of what's been done before, to a certain degree. While I like to think that I was doing something unique of putting these objects out in the land through an organization that I'm a member of, I discovered that there's an artist in Ireland whose work is related to mine. And we've actually connected up via social media. And yeah, it's great. It's really great. But it was a reminder that great ideas, which I think my idea is great. You should think your ideas are great. Otherwise, you'll never go anywhere if you think all your ideas are bad. other people have great ideas too. And sometimes they're related to your ideas, but they're different. Like I have found, I have tried to do installations in forests. I don't know what it is about a forest. I think it's because I feel claustrophobic. I can't see the sky. I can't breathe.
Same here.
Yep. The trees are closing in on me. I struggle with that. She does these beautiful installations in forests.
Oh, wow.
And I look at them and I'm just like, oh, but she's in Ireland. It's green. There are more trees. I'm in Wyoming. It's brown. Very few trees. And so it's important to think your ideas are great, but it's also important to know that somebody else may be having a very similar idea. You're not only one doing something.
Yeah, humans think alike. They do. I also want to ask you, because I think you're going to start a movement and there might be like a whole gang of flow junkies. Yeah, I know. If you were to become like the cult leader of flow junkies, I'm giving you a new title. The cult leader of flow junkies, what advice would you give to people to get their flow on?
Find your space, whatever that space may be, where mine is out in the land. I might experience some flow in my studio, but that's really hard because there's life. My studio is in my house. I've got a dog. I've got a family. I live in town. There are noises. It's hard to have my studio be flow. And I don't like headphones really. But find your space. That might be in your studio. That might be at your computer writing. And allow yourself to lose track of time.
Yeah.
That's the hard one, because in order to lose track of time, you have to block out time.
Yes. Yes.
And to have a day where and to be okay with being bored. I think flow can come from being bored, where you don't have a to-do list.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when I've experienced a bit of flow in my studio, it's often when I go down there with no particular intention. And I'm just, sometimes I just wander around looking at my stuff and all the different materials and little pieces of things that I have, and I'll just start playing with it and allow it to be play. Boredom and play, something that is really hard in our society.
It is. Giving yourself that permission just to go do that, not go down to the studio with an agenda, to be bored, to think. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Because when you have no agenda, then the mind can open up a little bit or a lot. And then you can get into flow and be part of the flow junkie cult.
Okay. I want to join the cult.
Movement.
I know. This podcast will probably get banned or we'll get bad comments. I'm like, oh, she's promoting a cult of flow junkies. We need to investigate this.
Of artists just allowing their minds to create. I have never taken drugs.
Either.
I have been accused of being high because my work when I was in college and right after, I did a lot of paintings and drawings that were humorous surrealism. According to an internet quiz, Salvador Dali is my spirit painter.
Oh, I love it. Love it.
Which at first I was like, what? And then I thought, yeah, I put things in situations or scenes where they may not necessarily belong. So it made sense to me then. But when some people have seen some of that work, they'll say, were you high?
I mean,
like, I was in flow.
Oh my gosh. Oh, it's amazing. I've never used drugs either. And I remember one time showing up, this is when I was in Fort Collins, at, it was like a Friday happy hour at someone's house. And another person that I knew was there, and she walked up to me and said, "Oh, I see you have red eyes." And I think trying to indicate that I might have been smoking something. I'm like, "Oh, no, it was because I haven't slept for 5 days, probably."
I was like,
I didn't at first think that, oh, she's trying to indicate something. But I was thinking about it later on. I was like, "Oh my gosh, I think she thought that I was using drugs. It's because I'm just about ready to drop from exhaustion and I haven't slept." And I'm still putting my contacts in trying to sleep. Like, as we digress.
But I think that's important, though, because you can be a very creative person without having influence outside of just what's in you. And I think that artists are often thought of as people that need something to get the creative juices flowing. And no shade on those who do. Whatever floats your boat, whatever works. That's just not me. I can go there. I can go into weird worlds without any assistance. And it all started back in that sandbox when I was a little girl.
I love it. I love it. I'm going to have you back. Hey, this has just been so much fun. I would like to ask the question I ask everyone.
I better get my nose.
It's a scary question.
I did think about it a lot.
How do you define innovation?
So I define innovation that if the million ideas I have in a day, choosing the one or two that are ripe is innovation. Because my ideas are not anything that has never happened before, as I said, but a couple of them of the million might be ripe.
That's great. So making some choice out of those too.
Yeah. Yeah. I came up with a bunch of different thoughts on what innovation means, but that was the one that I settled with because I could over-explain. Do you want me to over-explain it? It has been a blast. I so appreciate you asking me to do this, Yolanda, because you're an inspiration to me and what you're doing. And I haven't been able to watch all of the podcasts, but a few. And I'm like, it's almost overwhelming the amount of creativity that is out there. And you're tapping into some of it. And I can only imagine after you've interviewed a creative person, what must be spinning through your mind?
It truly is so inspirational to hear, like you said, learning people's processes, what drives them, and just telling the stories. I decided this week that I want to tell 1,000 stories.
That's awesome.
Yeah. You know what I'm going to be like my time. I need to get the rolling. I think I've only had 65 recorded, though. I have ways to go.
You gotta start somewhere.
I so appreciate having you here. I will have you back, and I encourage our audience to continue to follow your work.
Thank you.
And become a flow junkie. Join the gang, the cult, the movement, whatever you want to call it. Become a flow junkie. With Jennifer.
Yes.
And to our audience, if you're moved by her story, please continue to follow her on her social media. We'll make sure that is all tagged and listed in the show notes. And then remember to subscribe to the Innovation Insights podcast if you like discussions like this, and continue to explore the intersections of innovation, education, leadership, art, flow. That's such an important part of life. And just thank you for tuning in, and keep innovating, keep dreaming, and keep making a difference.